Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, forming the family in the faith, Pope Benedict charges Italy's bishops to tackle the challenge. Talks on a key accord between the Holy See and Israel get back on track after a series of hiccups. And Christians under threat in Pakistan. The family, faith formation, and young people were at the heart of Pope Benedict's address Thursday to Italy's Bishops' Conference. Emer McCarthy takes a look.
Speaking Thursday to Europe's largest gathering of bishops, Pope Benedict XVI remarked that the Catholic faith in Italy is alive and deeply rooted. He described the Italian Church as a people's church, a unifying factor for the nation and a great resource for the moral future of Italian society. But, he added, current difficulties cannot be ignored, such as the insidious advance of moral relativism, attempts to undermine marriage and the family, and the decreasing number of young men entering the priesthood.
Cari fratelli convescovi italiani, voi avete una precisa responsabilità non solo verso le chiese.
In his discourse, the Pope also recalled the prelates' attention to their specific responsibility, that is, the promotion of the common good, not only within the Church, but within the entire nation. The distinction between church and politics must be respected, he said. However, when politics touches on issues that are central to human dignity, issues such as the family, the church cannot remain in disparte. Pope Benedict praised the bishop's pastoral note on the family, which called Catholics' attention to legislation on de facto couples. He also had words of appreciation for their recent initiative of Family Day, when close to a million mothers and fathers from the length and breadth of Italy converged on the capital, together with their children, in support of the traditional family based on marriage.
Annunciare e testimoniare.
Charity and greater care for growing numbers of the country's hidden poor was another theme that Pope Benedict XVI dwelt on. While praising the numerous initiatives of parishes and dioceses throughout the peninsula, he reminded the bishops that serving the spiritual needs of the suffering should always accompany all charitable work. The Pope urged the bishops to redouble their evangelizing efforts, not only among the local populations, but to reach out to the vast number of immigrants who come in increasing numbers to seek a better future in Italy. Looking forward to the National Youth Gathering in Loreto later this year, he said that we know that youth formation is one of the most difficult tasks facing us today. But, he underlined, it is also one of the most important for the life of the Church.
Con questo animo vi assicuro la mia preghiera per l'Italia.
I'm Emer McCarthy.
Negotiations between the Holy See and the State of Israel got back on track this week after a five-year hiatus in talks focusing on the Church's property, tax status, and legal rights in the Holy Land. A joint statement issued after the May 21st meeting in the Vatican said the talks took place in an atmosphere of great cordiality, mutual understanding, and goodwill, and produced important progress. The Holy See and Israel agreed in late 1993 to establish full diplomatic relations, setting up a bilateral permanent working commission to negotiate a series of agreements on the Church's legal status and financial obligations. The first of these accords was called the Fundamental Agreement. Unfortunately, the latest talks have undergone a series of lengthy interruptions after the Israeli side declined to schedule meetings or canceled them. But Aaron Abramovich, Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and head of the Israeli delegation in this week's talks, says he sees negotiations now on a fast track towards conclusion, though no time limit has been set for a definitive accord.
We didn't set our time. You know, that this negotiation started a long time ago, but we really believe that we are in a very fast-track discussion this time. We already concluded that we are going to meet the plenary group in Jerusalem at the beginning of December. It's this year. And hopefully till then, we are going to have products from the meetings of the preparatory work that is going to be done. And then the next plenary meetings, we hope to conclude certain other issues that on our discussion and to see what kind of progress we can make, but I think that everybody means to have really serious discussions and serious achievements for the near future.
Did you set out a list of items that will be on the table in future discussions?
Yes, we had a list of issues. We are very organized, both sides, and we know what we did achieve. We know what there is for us to achieve in the near future, and we are going to discuss on these issues. We are going to meet almost every month on the working groups for the next few months, and we have the plenary in the beginning of December, so we believe that we'll have progress till then on the issues that we have agreed that we have to agree upon them.
Franciscan Father David Yeager is a member of the Vatican's delegation. He praised the progress made in this week's talks and told me he hoped the restarted negotiations will finally lead to an accord.
The negotiations overall on this subject have been going on for more than 8 years, since the 11th of March 1999. They are very much like building a house. What the negotiators do here is build a treaty. And each time they meet, they aim to add a few bricks to the house that is being built. An important aspect, too, which I don't know if everyone noticed reading the joint communique, is that the negotiations are entering a far more structured and planned phase. They will no longer be planned from time to time, with each meeting choosing when to meet the next time. Now there is a time frame. There is a time frame for the next plenary, the first half of December this year. And there is a mandate to the Working Level Commission to continue to work hard between now and then so as to have some tangible, considerable results to present to the plenary. This kind of structuring of the negotiations, which must develop an internal dynamics of accelerating them, is perhaps the best news to come out of the 21st of May. And I think it is in itself more significant than whatever further bricks have actually been added. And now, of course, the challenge is for these undertakings to be fully kept between now and then.
So, should Christians around the world be interested in the outcome of these accords? Father Yeager thinks they should.
The outcome of these negotiations is to be to gain security for the Church's presence in the Holy Land.
Let me just ask you another question. A security in today's world means a physical security with terrorism and so on. So what are you talking about, though?
I'm speaking about legal security. Physical security is simply a brute fact. It is not yet real security. In our case, security means legal security, means knowing what are your rights and what are your obligations, rather than sitting there trembling, waiting for whatever capriciousness may guide the powers that be on any given day in dealing with you. This is why the representatives of the Church have been speaking very emphatically of a rules-based relationship as being the overall purpose of the talks with Israel, and it is a rules-based relationship that alone can give the Church's presence in Israel security, stability, and the ability to grow and to plan.
Let's get down to the nuts and bolts of these accords. What are you talking about exactly?
Several things. More than anything else, it is necessary to obtain recognition of the rights acquired to the Church in the many centuries prior to the establishment of the State of Israel. And recognition that the modern state in 1948 was not established on a tabula rasa, on the desert. It was established in an area where others already existed, and non-state actors already existed, and had already acquired rights that were their own, and not dependent on the benevolent concession of the modern state.
So you're talking about the Arabs and the Palestinians?
In this context, we are speaking about the Catholic Church. It is not for us to say anything about anyone else. The principle, though, that we invoke is that when any state arises, say 60 years ago, it cannot pretend that there was nothing and no one where it was arising. And in fact, we say, where it arose, the Catholic Church already was and had been for nearly two millennia. And for several centuries at least, the Catholic Church had been acquiring visibly legal rights by treaty through the decisions of international bodies. And this is where the relationship starts, with recognition that this is so.
By the same token, other Christian churches, such as the Orthodox, have also been present for centuries as well. Will this kind of accord between the Vatican and the State of Israel affect other Christian churches?
This cannot be known. Of course, the Catholic Church cannot negotiate on behalf of anyone else, only on behalf of herself. It certainly cannot have an adverse effect. It might have a beneficial effect if the security that is given to Catholics is thereby, by analogy, spreads to others too. Well, God bless them, but it cannot be directly encompassed in the bilateral negotiations.
If this agreement is signed, it will be just one more brick in the building of a new palazzo, a new building, let's say, because there are other agreements which the Holy See and the State of Israel must sign.
Yes, indeed. Thing is that in 1992, when the fundamental agreement, the first agreement ever, was under negotiation, under construction between the Holy See and the State of Israel, the parties together made a methodological decision to have the fundamental agreement first, with its great norms, some practical norms, but also the great norms for the relationship, and to follow it with a series of particular agreements on particular subjects. And so certainly, the agreement now being negotiated on the Church's security in fiscal and property terms is only needed to complete the fundamental agreement itself, which foresees thereupon agreements on such matters as urgent pastoral matters like access by ministers of the Church to persons in confined situations, such as prisoners above all, hospital patients, soldiers who are Catholics and who require the ministration of religious assistance of Catholic chaplains and priests, or, again, another very urgent matter, rules for visas and residence permits for Catholic clergy and religious personnel. Another agreement which was identified already officially in 1995 as necessary will have to do with the correct presentation of Christ, Christianity and the Church in the Israeli public educational system, just the way that the Church has carried out a tremendous effort revising presentation of Jews and Judaism in Catholic religious education over the last decade since the Second Vatican Council. It is time to verify how well this has been reciprocated. Then there are other agreements that arise from the fundamental agreement. There may be further agreements on the promotion of pilgrimages and the protection of the character of pilgrims, and so on and so forth. That is, this is an ongoing relationship that is built on building up a series of treaties, that is, further rooms or floors in the entire house.
Father David Yeager, a member of the Vatican delegation in those talks with the State of Israel. And earlier, you heard Aaron Abramovich, Director General of the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and head of Israel's delegation. Christians in the town of Sharsada in northwest Pakistan have faced mounting threats from Islamic extremists demanding they convert to Islam or die. A letter recently circulated in the town warned Christians they had a deadline, May 17th, to become Muslim or face dire consequences and bombings. This week, fresh threats from a group calling itself the Taliban's Detonative Department. The rising tension comes amid efforts by minorities to push through proposed amendments to Pakistan's blasphemy laws. The National Assembly overwhelmingly rejected the proposal earlier in May. Well, under existing blasphemy laws, anyone convicted of offending the Prophet Muhammad faces life imprisonment or death. Opponents of the current law want it repealed, or at the very least, amended to a 5-year prison sentence and a fine. They also want the law to apply to offenses concerning other faiths, too. Well, earlier I spoke to Bishop Anthony Lobo of Islamabad and Rawalpindi, who told me that some of the small Christian community have fled Sharsada, fearing for their lives, despite government assurances that it will do what it can to protect Christians there.
Some of the Christians are shifting their women and children out of that area, but they don't know where to put them. It's rather strange that we are being made refugees inside our own country. Religion should not be spread by the sword. It is the government of the province that should provide security for our people, but despite our request, they have not yet provided any security.
Bishop Lobo was speaking to me Monday, the day the extremists' deadline expired. He told me international coverage of a press conference he held that day may have shamed the government into taking action.
This press conference was carried by CNN and BBC TV, which caused some embarrassment. And as a result, the government instructed the newspapers not to report it. And the extremists also threatened the press if they report it. But one paper, an English paper, reported it extensively and also put a picture of the press conference with me in it. Now, as a result of that publicity given internationally on the TV, there was a cabinet meeting in the provincial capital of Peshawar, under which Sharsada comes. And now the chief minister has at last decided to provide full security to the Christians of Sharsada. Then the European Union embassy is contacting other European ambassadors to make a joint demarche and present it to the government of Pakistan. Then the U.S. Embassy is contacting the President's Secretariat about the same problem. Now, in addition, we have contacted the local secular-minded Muslims of the Awami National Party who have promised to help the Christians there and to do their best to protect them. We have also contacted some very well-known Islamic scholars like Mr. Gandhi, and asked him to give a statement that religion should not be spread by force and forced conversions are against Islam. So also the chairman of the Islamic Ideology Council, which is a constitutional body, the chairman has been approached to give a similar statement that forced conversions are against Islam. And finally, we have sent 10 persons to stay with and around the 50 Christian families, totaling 500 persons, to stay with them. And through these people, we are monitoring the situation continuously because the deadline expires 17th May.
Is this an isolated incident? Does anyone have any idea who was behind these threats?
It's difficult because they don't identify themselves. It's anonymous. But our people are taking it seriously. Now I heard, although there's no letter, which I've seen, the people of Mardan, which is another town not far from Peshawar, where they have been orally given threats of the same kind. And then when they contacted some of their Muslim friends in Mardan, they were told, I think you better convert. That will solve the problem. So with friends like that.
What is the percentage of Christians in the country today, and what other minorities in Pakistan are affected by the anti-blasphemy laws that are in place?
Actually, the blasphemy law affects anyone who says anything derogatory against the Prophet, for which there is a death penalty, or desecrates the holy book Quran, and for which there is a life imprisonment. Now, it not only affects minorities, although most of them might be minorities, it affects even Muslims. Right now there are two or three cases of Muslims who are accused of blasphemy. The percentage of Christians in the population is 2%, but the percentage of Hindus is also 2%.
I know that the anti-blasphemy legislation in Pakistan has been challenged by some of the minority groups. Is it a law based on a strict interpretation of the Quran?
Actually, it's more the Sharia than the holy book itself. Because you see, there are various ways in which you can interpret the Sharia. Now, for instance, this law is the only law in the whole world, not only in this country, where the intention to commit derogatory statement against the Prophet is not considered. Now, in all crimes, it has to be willful and deliberate if it is called a crime. Otherwise, it's an accident. So here, no distinction is made between an accident and a deliberate, willful offense. So that's a very strange law, and even Muslim scholars say it should be changed. But they don't expect any change to be made until after the elections, because that could be used by fundamentalists to attack the government if it changes it.
But how concerned are Christians and other minorities about these laws? What are some of the risks that they can face?
You see, anybody at any time can be picked up. Generally, we found when Christians are accused, there's an ulterior motive, some vested interest, which they want either to acquire his land, his house, or take away his job. And then they put a false accusation of blasphemy. Now, the trouble with that is, they don't wait for the police to arrest or the judge to try the person, in which case the person will be acquitted because it's a false accusation. But the mob, they rush in and they lynch the person. That's the trouble.
What happens, Bishop Lobo, if a Muslim, for example, wishes to convert to Christianity or another religion?
Interestingly, they've just presented a bill in the National Assembly, which is our House of Parliament at the federal level, national parliament, and it's presented by the fundamentalist members of parliament to say if any Muslim renounces Islam, he should be killed. They want to pass that law. By the way, this is in their Sharia, so this is one way of getting the Sharia in. Any Muslim converting has to be killed. So what the government has done, it sent it to a select committee for study. They're trying to stall.
One would assume that, for example, even going to a Christian church could be construed by some people then as an insult to the Prophet Muhammad.
No, that is not done. And there are many people who visit our grotto and grottos all over the country. There are some people that come for charismatic healing services and claim they are healed. So that goes on. Because you see, everyone in this country who is a Muslim is not an extremist. A lot of them get on very well with Christians, but since these things are highlighted in the press, one would think that everyone here is a fundamentalist, is an extremist, is a terrorist. It's these kind of news items that make the image of the country, unfortunately. But as I say, there are many people who get on well with us.
What do international bodies like the UN say about the rights of religious minorities in Pakistan? And you mentioned there has been some stepped up international pressure on the country to be more tolerant towards its religious minorities.
You see, the United States brings out a human rights report and we don't get very high marks on that. Then in Geneva, every year, I think it is Geneva, there's a meeting of the United Nations Human Rights and Rights of Minorities meeting every year. And there is the place where a lot of embarrassment is caused. And they generally try to send kind of Christian who sides with the government to sort of whitewash the whole thing. But it doesn't stop the international bodies and NGOs and all from bringing facts and figures, which is embarrassing.
So are you basically just waiting until the elections happen to see what happens next?
The government spokesman, he's a senator and also information secretary of the ruling party, he said that we are going to amend it, but we have to wait till after the elections, because if we do it now, this will be used against us in the elections by the extremists. That's what he said. After the election, there might be a change in the makeup of the parliament. And if that happens, then it will be easier to pass the law. But right now, it will prejudice the outcome of the elections if these people say that they are amending our religious law and therefore don't vote for them, and then they might even lose or get very, very few seats, and then the fundamentalists will get more seats. So that's why they're saying we're going to bring it after the election. But he said it quite frankly. I was surprised that he said it.
Legislative elections are scheduled for October 2007 in Pakistan. But how can Christians outside the country show their solidarity with the local church? Bishop Lobo says one way is to take up pen and paper and to write to Pakistani authorities. Another, he says, is to get on the web.
We have a thing called Hotline, comes out of Hong Kong, and they write in to the president of the country and to the prime minister and to the chief minister of the province, saying that we are very distressed to see what is going on and hope that Christians will be given their rights and due protection so that they can live in peace and harmony with their Muslim brothers and work as they have always been doing for the progress and development of the country. So if many letters come like that, they will sit up.
You know, if a Muslim here in Europe were threatened with death if he didn't convert to Christianity, there would be an international outrage. Does it make you a little upset that there's no Christian outrage over what's happening?
You see, the laws of those countries are very liberal and they grant a lot of rights to every religion. Whereas here, laws, as you well know, are different. So we have to be more careful here. But there they would be protected and defended by the state. Here we've got to evolve a strategy to get the state to defend us, as you have noticed in what I said. Vatican Radio, pray for us.
Bishop Anthony Lobo of Islamabad and Rawalpindi, Pakistan. Well, he was talking about Hotline Asia, an internet site online with the help of the Asian Center for Progress of Peoples, an independent organization based in Hong Kong. Both work to remedy social injustices and to further peace in Asia. You'll find them on the web at hotlineasia.org and acpp.org. That's acpp.org for the Asian Center for Progress of Peoples. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.